Supreme Court of Canada update, Rogers Communications Inc. and Voltage Pictures LLC, 2018 SCC 38. The judgment of Chief Justice Wagner, Justices Abella, Moldaver, Karakatsanis, Gascon, Brown, Roe, and Martin was delivered by Justice Brown. Part 1, Introduction. Paragraph 1. Online infringement of copyright has been commonplace. Using peer-to-peer file-sharing networks, internet subscribers can download copyrighted materials such as films and music, while simultaneously uploading that content for download by others who are thereby able to do the same. Throughout this concurrent downloading and uploading, peer-to-peer networks facilitate the rapid sharing of copyrighted material with multiple internet subscribers simultaneously. And due to the anonymity of the internet, the identity of internet subscribers who participate in this illegal sharing of copyrighted content is concealed from copyright owners. 2. In 2009, the Government of Canada launched a consultation on copyright modernization to address the issue of online copyright infringement. It heard both from copyright owners who demanded a way to discourage online copyright infringement and consumers who requested a method to determine if they or someone using their internet protocol, IP address, could be infringing copyright. 3. Parliament responded to both sets of concerns by enacting the, quote, notice and notice, end quote, regime contained within sections 41.25 and 41.26 of the Copyright Act, which regime was brought into force on January 2, 2015. Now, when a copyright owner gives notice to an internet service provider, an ISP, claiming that a person at a certain IP address has infringed the owner's copyright, the ISP must forward that notice of claimed infringement to the person to whom the IP address, being the electronic location identified by the location data specified in the notice, according to section 41.26 sub 1 sub A, was assigned. While this regime is intended to deter the continued infringement of copyright online, it only goes so far. In particular, it does not require an ISP to disclose the identity of a person who has received a notice to the copyright owner. For a copyright owner to obtain that person's identity, the owner must proceed outside the regime, specifically by obtaining a Norwich order compelling the ISP to disclose it. See Norwich Pharmaceutical Company and Customs and Excise Commissioners, 1974 AC 133, House of Lords decision. For this appeal requires this court to consider who bears the ISP's, quote, reasonable costs of compliance, end quote, with a Norwich order. At common law, that burden rests with the copyright owner. In enacting the notice and notice regime, however, Parliament prohibited ISPs from charging a fee for complying with their obligations under the regime, except, as I shall explain, where the minister has fixed a maximum fee by regulation, which has not occurred to date. This leaves open the question of whether, if any of the steps taken by an ISP to comply with a Norwich order overlap with an ISP's obligations under the notice and notice regime, the ISP can recover the costs of such duplicative steps as part of its reasonable cost of compliance with the Norwich order. Part 2, Overview of Facts and Proceedings, Subpart A, Paragraph 5. The respondents to this appeal, collectively Voltage, are film production companies that allege that their copyrights have been infringed online. Specifically, Voltage says that thousands of internet subscribers, whom it cannot identify, have, in contravention of the act, shared its films over the internet using peer-to-peer file-sharing networks. Voltage sued one such unknown person, quote, John Doe, end quote, alleging breach of copyright in relation to the concurrent downloading and uploading of a number of films on various dates. Ultimately, Voltage says it intends to have its action against John Doe certified as a so-called reverse class action against approximately 55,000 persons whose identities are currently unknown, but who Voltage says have similarly infringed its copyright. To this end, Voltage brought a motion for a Norwich order compelling John Doe's ISP, Rogers Communications Inc., to disclose, quote, any and all of John Doe's contact and personal information, end quote. Voltage also sought that the disclosure order be made with, quote, no fees or disbursements payable, quote, to Rogers, quote, pursuant to sections 41.25 and 41.26 of the Act, end quote. Paragraph 6. Sections 41.25 and 41.26 of the Act describe the provision of notice of a claimed copyright infringement as occurring in two steps. First, a copyright owner must send a notice of the claimed infringement to an ISP such as Rogers. This step is prescribed by Section 41.25, which reads, Notice of Claimed Infringement, 41.25 sub 1. An owner of the copyright in a work or other subject matter may send a notice of claimed infringement to a person who provides A. The means in the course of providing services related to the operation of the internet or another digital network of telecommunications through which the electronic location that is subject of the claim of infringement is connected to the internet or another digital network. B. For the purpose set out in subsection 31.14, the digital memory that is used for the electronic location to which the claim of infringement relates. Or C, an information location tool as identified in subsection 41.27.5. Form and content of notice is under section 41.25.2. A notice of claimed infringement shall be in writing in the form, if any, prescribed by regulation, and shall A, state the claimant's name and address and any other particulars prescribed by regulation that enable communication with the claimant, B, identify the work or other subject matter to which the claimed infringement relates, C, state the claimant's interest or right with respect to the copyright in the work or other subject matter, D, specify the location data for the electronic location to which the claimed infringement relates, E, specify the infringement that is claimed, F, specify the date and time of the commission of the claimed infringement, and G, contain any other information that may be prescribed by regulation. Secondly, the ISP must, upon receiving the copyright owner's notice of claimed infringement, quote, forward the notice electronically to the person to whom the electronic location, in this case an IP address, is identified, end quote, in the notice belongs. This second step is prescribed by subsection 41.26.1, which imposes upon the ISP certain obligations, the scope of which are central to deciding this appeal. Obligations related to notice 41.26 sub 1. A person described in paragraph 41.25.1a or b who receives a notice of claimed infringement that complies with section 41.25 sub 2 shall, on being paid any fee that the person has lawfully charged for doing so, A, as soon as feasible, forward the notice electronically to the person to whom the electronic location identified by the location data specified in the notice belongs, and informs the claimant of its forwarding, or, if applicable, of the reason why it was not possible to forward it, and B, retain records that allow the identity of the person to whom the electronic location belongs to be determined, and to do so for 6 months beginning on the day on which the notice of claimed infringement is received, or if the claimant commences proceedings related to the claimed infringement and so notifies the person before the end of those 6 months, for 1 year after the day on which the person receives the notice of claimed infringement. Paragraph 7.
Section 41.26 sub 2 of the Act addresses whether an ISP may charge a fee for complying with these obligations. Quote, fees related to notices, sub 2, the minister may by regulation fix the maximum fee that a person may charge for performing his or her obligations under subsection 1. If no maximum is fixed by regulation, the person may not charge any amount under that subsection. To date, the minister has not fixed a maximum fee. By operation of subsection 41.26(2), therefore, no fee may be charged by an ISP for complying with its obligations under subsection 41.26(1). Paragraph 8. Hence, the issue to be decided. Could the scope of Rogers' obligations as an ISP under subsection 41.26(1) first overlap entirely with the steps which Rogers may be required to take under Voltage's Norwich order? And if so, may Rogers still charge a fee for its reasonable cost of compliance with the Norwich order? Second, not overlap with those steps, in which case, would Rogers be entitled to his reasonable costs of compliance with the order? Or third, overlap in part with those steps, and if so, to what extent may Rogers still charge a fee for the reasonable costs of compliance with such overlapping steps? As I explained below, on this point, the courts below diverged. While the motion judge's reasons are not entirely clear, he appeared to assume that the second view was correct. Since sections 41.25 and 41.26 did not, in his view, oust, quote, established law and principles with respect to Norwich orders, end quote. That was at paragraph 12 of his judgment. He therefore allowed Rogers to recover the costs of all steps it was said were necessary to comply with the Norwich order. The Federal Court of Appeals interpretation would, however, have confined Rogers' recovery to the reasonable costs of the actual act of disclosure when complying with the Norwich order. The court saw the rest of Rogers' claimed costs as unrecoverable since they overlapped with the steps that formed part of Rogers' implicit obligations under the statutory regime. Subpart B, Judicial History, beginning with the federal court case, neutral citation 2016 FC 881. Reasons by Justice Boswell. Paragraph 9. As already recounted, Voltage sought a Norwich order compelling Rogers to disclose the identity of, quote, any and all contact and personal information, end quote, of John Doe with, quote, no fees or disbursements payable, end quote, to Rogers pursuant to sections 41.25 and 41.26 of the Act. At the hearing of the motion, Rogers took no position on whether Voltage was entitled to the Norwich order. It maintained, however, that if the order were granted, Rogers should be entitled to recover from Voltage its reasonable cost of compliance with the order, which Rogers calculated at a rate of $100 per hour plus HST. Paragraph 10. The motion judge granted the order, but considering the privacy interests that surround the disclosure of an internet subscriber's identity, he ordered that Rogers disclose only John Doe's, quote, name and address as recorded in Rogers' records, end quote. The motion judge then considered and accepted Rogers' argument that it was entitled to compliance costs. He reasoned that while the statutory notice and notice regime regulates the process by which notice of a claimed copyright infringement is provided to both an ISP and an internet subscriber, and while it also regulates the retention of records relating to that notice, the regime does not regulate an ISP's disclosure of a subscriber's identity to a copyright owner. Obtaining such disclosure requires an owner to obtain a Norwich order, and at common law, the ISP is entitled to recover its reasonable costs of compliance. Paragraph 11. Turning to what Rogers had actually claimed.
The hourly fee of $100 plus HST, the motion judge found that, quote, the fee is what it is, end quote, and held that Voltage was required to pay it prior to obtaining disclosure of John Doe's name and address. He further found that Roger's compliance with the order should take no more than an hour, estimating that Voltage would be required to reimburse Roger's approximately $113 inclusive of HST. He also ordered that Rogers was entitled to the costs of the motion, which he fixed at $500. Now moving on to the Federal Court of Appeal judgment, neutral citation 2017 FCA 97, reasons by Justice Stratus, with Justices Gleason and Woods concurring. Paragraph 12. The Federal Court of Appeal allowed Voltage's appeal. The outcome of the appeal turned on the interpretation of the statutory notice and notice regime. The court found that the purpose of the regime was, quote, to reduce the complications and answer many of the questions that can arise when a Norwich order is sought, end quote. And to, quote, protect and vindicate the rights of copyright owners, end quote. The regime must therefore be interpreted so as to, quote, to allow copyright owners to protect and vindicate their rights as quickly, easily, and efficiently, as possible, while ensuring fair treatment of all. Paragraph 13, the Federal Court of Appeal identified various obligations in subsection 41.26(1), both express and implicit, which an ISP must satisfy under the regime. First, under paragraph 41.26(1)(a), expressly requires an ISP to forward notice of a claimed copyright infringement to the person to whom the electronic location specified in the notice belongs. An implicit corollary to this obligation and to the overall purposes of the regime, however, is a set of obligations requiring the ISP to, quote, maintain its records in a manner and form that allow it to identify suspected infringers quickly and efficiently, search for and locate the relevant records, analyze the records to satisfy itself that it has identified the suspected infringers accurately, end quote, and undertake verification, quote, to the extent the ISP must conduct verification activities to ensure accuracy, end quote. Paragraph 14. Secondly, paragraph 41.26(1)(a) expressly requires an ISP to notify the copyright owner that the notice has been forwarded or explain why it could not do so. 15. An ISP's third express obligation, described in paragraph 41.26(1)(b), requires it to, quote, retain records that, quote, will allow the identity of the person to whom the electronic location belongs to be determined, end quote. The Federal Court of Appeal found that the, quote, records, end quote, are those which an ISP has used to identify a person under paragraph 41.26(1)(a) for the purposes of forwarding notice. It further found that such records must be maintained in a manner and form that is usable by, quote, those who will use the records, end quote, being copyright owners and courts, to identify the person who received notice. To the extent that the records are not in such a form, an ISP is required to, quote, translate or modify, end quote, the records into a usable form as part of its paragraph 41.26(1)(b) obligations. 16. The Federal Court of Appeal agreed with the motion judge that the absence of the regulation prescribing a maximum fee precludes Rogers from charging a fee for discharging its statutory obligations. It also agreed that the statutory notice and notice regime does not regulate the disclosure of a person's identity from an ISP's records. From this, it follows that a copyright owner seeking to have an ISP disclose a person's identity must obtain a Norwich order. and an ISP can charge a fee for the, quote, actual, reasonable, and necessary costs associated with the act of disclosure, end quote. Once, however, an ISP performs its statutory obligations without compensation under the notice and notice regime, the act of disclosure itself is a simple matter. Quote, all that is left is the delivery or electronics transmission of these records by the ISP to the copyright owner, and the ISP's participation in the obtaining of a disclosure order from the court, end quote. The associated costs are therefore likely to be negligible. 17. The Federal Court of Appeal found that Rogers appeared to have satisfied its obligations under the notice and notice regime, but, in response to Voltage's request for disclosure, had, quote, redone some of its work in order to verify its earlier work and ensure accuracy, end quote. Rogers' fee of $100 per hour was, quote, based mainly on the cost of this additional work, end quote. The motion judge had therefore erred by allowing Rogers to charge for work that it was already required to perform under the notice and notice regime. He also erred by failing to assess the reasonableness of Rogers' fee, instead simply concluding that, quote, the fee is what it is, end quote. The court set aside the motion judge's order that Rogers reimburse Voltage at a rate of $100 per hour plus HST, and, finding insufficient evidence on the record to determine Rogers' actual reasonable and necessary costs of compliance, concluded that Rogers was not entitled to any reimbursement. On the basis that costs must follow the event, the Federal Court of Appeal set aside the motion judge's award of legal costs and instead ordered Rogers itself to pay Voltage's costs on the appeal and in the federal court. Part 3, Analysis. Subpart A, Introduction, Paragraph 18. Originally cast as an equitable bill of discovery, see the cases Norwich along with Glaxo Wellcome PLC and MNR, a Norwich order is a type of pre-trial discovery which, inter alia, allows a rights holder to identify wrongdoers. See Alberta Treasury Branches and Leahy, 2000 Alberta Court of Queen's Bench. The elements of the test for obtaining a Norwich order, although sometimes described as factors to be considered, see Leahy, Queen's Bench, are not in dispute before us. A copyright owner must show a bona fide claim against the unknown alleged wrongdoer, b, the person from whom the discovery is sought must be in some way involved in the matter under dispute. He must be more than an innocent bystander. C, the person from whom discovery is sought must be the only practical source of information available to the applicants. D, the person from whom discovery is sought must be reasonably compensated for his expenses arising out of compliance with the discovery order in addition to his legal costs. E, the public interests in favor of disclosure must outweigh the legitimate privacy concerns. C, BMG Canada and John Doe, 2005, Federal Court of Appeal, quoting BMG Canada, Inc. and John Doe, 2004, Federal Court, Voltage Pictures, LLC and John Doe, 2015, Federal Court, Voltage Pictures, LLC and John Doe, 2014, Federal Court. Paragraph 19, both Rogers and Voltage agree that the statutory notice and notice regime has not displaced the necessity of a copyright owner obtaining a Norwich order in order to compel an ISP to disclose the identity of a person who is alleged to have committed an infringement of copyright. Again, this appeal concerns the relationship between the necessary steps to comply with that statutory regime and the steps necessary to comply with a Norwich order, and the implications of that relationship for an ISP's ability to recover the costs of complying with a Norwich order. Subpart B, Interpretation of the Notice and Notice Regime, paragraph 20. Statutory interpretation entails discerning Parliament's intent by examining, in this case, the words of sections 41.25 and 41.26 in their entire context and in their grammatical and ordinary sense, in harmony with the Act's scheme and objectives. See Rizzo and Rizzo Shoes, Supreme Court of Canada, 1998. Subheading 1, The Scheme of the Act, paragraph 21. The Act states that rights of copyright owners, the conduct that infringes those rights, and the civil and criminal remedies that may be sought or enforced where those rights are infringed,
Part 4 of the Act, entitled Remedies, also describes the procedure to be followed where a copyright owner alleges an infringement and seeks to enforce its rights under the Act. One such set of procedures is contained in the notice and notice provisions described in sections 41.25 and 41.26. Subheading 2, the Act's Objectives. Subheading 2, the Act's Objectives. Paragraph 22. The notice and notice regime was enacted as part of the Copyright Modernization Act to serve two complementary purposes. One, to deter online copyright infringement, and two, to balance the rights of interested parties. Paragraph 23. That first purpose, deterrence, is evident in the preamble to the Copyright Modernization Act, which states that the Government of Canada is committed to enhancing the protection of copyright works or other subject matter. This purpose is echoed in the summary of the Copyright Modernization Act, which states that the Act is amended to, quote, update the rights and protections of copyright owners to better address the challenges and opportunities of the Internet, end quote. The consultation letter from the Government of Canada, which invited stakeholders to make submissions on the form and content of notice, also similarly stated that the notice and notice regime's, quote, primary goal is to deter infringement, end quote. More particularly, by requiring notice of a claimed infringement to be forwarded to the person who was associated with the IP address that is alleged to have infringed copyright, the regime is aimed at deterring that person or others who are using the IP address from continuing to infringe copyright. See Canada Office of Consumer Affairs Notice and Notice Regime online. 24. The Notice and Notice Regime was not, however, intended to embody a comprehensive framework by which instances of online copyright infringement could be eliminated altogether. As a representative of Rogers explained before the House of Commons committee considering what would become the Copyright Modernization Act, quote, notice and notice is not a silver bullet. It's just the first step in a process by which rights holders can go after those who they allege are infringing. Then the rights holder can use that when they decide to take that alleged infringer to court, end quote. This is why, as I have explained, a copyright owner who wishes to sue a person alleged to have infringed copyright online must obtain a Norwich order to compel the ISP to disclose that person's identity. The statutory notice and notice regime has not displaced this requirement, but operates in tandem with it. This is affirmed by paragraph 41.26(1)(b), which contemplates that a copyright owner may sue a person who receives notice under the regime and fixes the ISP's obligation to retain records which allow that person's identity to be determined for a period of time after such notice is received. 25. The second purpose of sections 41.25 and 41.26 is, quote, to balance the interests of all stakeholders in the copyright regime, end quote. That quote was taken from the House of Commons debates on October 18, 2011. This involves not only balancing the rights of copyright owners and internet users who may infringe those rights, but also the interests of internet intermediaries such as ISPs. See the explanatory note relating to the Copyright Modernization Act in the Canada Gazette from July 2nd, 2014, Part 2 of the Gazette, and also the Legislative Committee on Bill C-32, Evidence, at page 1. For this reason, this balance manifests itself within the notice and notice regime in several ways. 26. For example, Parliament sought to strike a balance between the interests of copyright owners and of internet subscribers respectively by preferring a notice and notice regime over a, quote, notice and take down, end quote, regime. See the House of Commons debates per Honorable James Moore. The notice and takedown regime prescribed in the United States by the Digital Millennium Copyright Act from 1998 requires an online service provider, upon receiving notice of a claimed copyright infringement, to respond expeditiously by removing or blocking access to the material that is the subject of the claimed infringement. While obviously a preferable scheme from the standpoint of copyright owners, its quote takedown end quote requirement has been criticized as undermining the presumption of innocence and unnecessarily limiting free speech. See, for example, the comments of the Electronic Frontier Foundation before the U.S. Copyright Office, Library of Congress, in the matter of Section 512 study, submitted by C. McSherry and K. Walsh, April 1, 2016. See also an article entitled Notice and Takedown in Everyday Practice from March 2017, and an article entitled Free Speech Unmoored in Copyright Safe Harbor, Chilling Effects of the DCMA on the First Amendment. That article was published in the Harvard Journal of Law and Technology in 2010. In contrast, the notice and notice regime allows for notices of claimed infringement to be forwarded, thereby advancing the rights of copyright holders, while accounting for the interests of internet subscribers by maintaining the presumption of innocence and allowing them to monitor their own behavior, and more specifically, to avoid continued copyright infringement. 27. Parliament also sought to balance the interests of copyright owners against those of internet intermediaries such as ISPs. While the provisions within the Copyright Modernization Act came into force on November 7, 2012, the coming into force of sections 41.25 and 41.26 was delayed to allow for parliamentary consultation with stakeholders on the implementation of the notice and notice regime and on the possibility of accompanying regulations. Parliament ultimately chose to enact the notice and notice regime without regulations, thereby prohibiting ISPs from charging a fee for complying with their statutory obligations. See the explanatory note, along with a statutory instrument, SI 2014-58. However, the amendments to the Act were also intended to, quote, clarify internet service providers' liability, end quote, to copyright owners. See the Copyright Modernization Act summary. See also the Legislative Committee on Bill C-32, evidence, per Craig McTaggart. To that end, Parliament insulated ISPs from liability for the copyright infringement of internet subscribers, Section 31.1. Now, to attract liability under the Act, an ISP must fail to satisfy its statutory obligations under the notice and notice regime, or provide a service, quote, primarily for the purpose of enabling acts of copyright infringement, end quote. Sections 27 sub 2.3, 31.1, and 41.26 sub 3. Subheading 3, the ordinary meaning of section 41.26 in light of the scheme and objects of the Act. Paragraph 28. Taking the Act's scheme and objectives into account, what is the ordinary and grammatical reading of the text of section 41.26? Or as Justice Gontier phrased it in the Canadian Pacific Airlines Limited and Canada Airlines Pilots Association case from 1993, Supreme Court of Canada, what is, quote, the natural meaning which appears when section 41.26 is simply read through, end quote. See also R. Sullivan on Construction of Statutes, 6th edition, 2014. 29. Recall that section 41.26 sub 1 imposes three express obligations upon an ISP that receives a copyright owner's notice of claimed copyright infringement. First, to, quote, forward the notice electronically to the person to whom the electronic location identified by the location data specified in the notice belongs, section 41.26 sub 1, A, 2, to, quote, inform the copyright owner of its forwarding or of the reason why it was not possible to forward it, end quote. Section 41.26 sub 1 sub A. And 3, to, quote, retain records that will allow the identity of the person to whom the electronic location belongs to be determined. Section 41.26 sub 1 sub B. On this, all parties are agreed. The parties are also agreed that the text of Section 41.26 sub 2 provides that because the minister has not, quote, by regulation fixed the maximum fee that a person may charge for performing his or her obligations under subsection 1, end quote, an ISP, quote, may not charge any amount, end quote, for the costs incurred in satisfying these three express obligations. Where the parties disagree, and where the courts below disagreed, is on whether those express obligations carry with them certain implicit obligations, the cost of which an ISP cannot recover from a copyright owner. Subheading A, Section 41.26, Sub 1, Sub A, Paragraph 30. The first two express obligations of an ISP, forwarding notice to the person to whom the IP address belonged, and confirming to the copyright owner that such notice has been forwarded, are required by paragraph 41.26(1)(a) to be performed, quote, as soon as feasible, end quote. 31. When considering the text, context, and object of paragraph 41.26(1)(a), it becomes quickly apparent that there is more to these obligations than merely forwarding notice and confirming that it has been forwarded. As the Federal Court of Appeal observed, the Act's purposes, and indeed the requirement that an ISP perform these obligations, quote, as soon as feasible, end quote, will be undermined where an ISP has not taken steps enabling it to do its work, quote, quickly and efficiently, end quote. But at an even more fundamental level, the obligations to forward and confirm connote accompanying implicit duties, that is, steps which are necessary to see those express statutory obligations are discharged. First, it is obvious that in order for an ISP to, quote, forward the notice electronically to the person to whom the electronic location belongs, end quote, the ISP must have determined, for the purposes of forwarding notice electronically, to whom, in this case, the IP address belonged. To be clear, and as I will explain, this does not require an ISP to identify that person by name. In this case, for example, Rogers says that it determines who was assigned an IP address at that time in question by manually or automatically correlating that IP address with the email address which belongs to its assignee. And secondly, an ISP must also take any action that is necessary for it to verify that it has made that determination accurately. 32. That these implicit identification and verification obligations form part of an ISP's burden under paragraph 41.26(1)(a) is evident from the text of the provision itself. Specifically, paragraph 41.26(1)(a) requires not only that an ISP forward notice, but also that it inform the copyright owner, quote, of its forwarding, end quote, or of the reason forwarding failed. As a matter of logic and good sense, the proper operation of this aspect of the notice and notice regime is premised upon an ISP having accurately determined to whom notice must be forwarded. As the Federal Court of Appeals said, quote, for the regime to work, accuracy must be ensured, end quote. Were ISPs permitted to forward a notice to the wrong person, then confirm it had been forwarded correctly, such confirmations would, from the standpoint of copyright owners, be unreliable and therefore meaningless. Neither the ISP nor copyright owner would ever know if the notice had reached the right person, being the person to whom the IP address identified in the notice belonged. 33. The importance of accuracy is further underscored by the scheme of the notice and notice regime. Specifically, under subsection 41.26.3, where an ISP fails to correctly forward notice to the person to whom the impugned IP address actually belonged, an ISP may be liable to the copyright owner for statutory damages in the amount of no less than $5,000 and no more than $10,000. This statutory liability is a clear affirmation of the ISP's obligation. Each time it receives notice from a copyright owner, to ensure that it forwards that notice to the correct person. Moreover, if accuracy were not found to be paramount in an ISP's satisfaction of its obligations under paragraph 41.26.1a, the balance struck by Parliament in enacting the notice and notice regime would be defeated, since copyright owners would be stripped of their advantage thereunder. ISPs would be insulated from liability to copyright owners, not only where they met their statutory obligations under the notice and notice regime, but also where they effectively failed to do so. 34. The deterrent purpose of the notice and notice regime also affirms the ISP's duty to correctly determine to whom the impugned IP address belonged at the time of the alleged infringement. Deterring online copyright infringement entails notifying that person, because it is only that person who is capable of stopping continued online copyright infringement. 35. I acknowledge that there will likely be instances where the person who received notice of a claimed copyright infringement will not in fact have illegally shared copyrighted content online. This might occur, for example, where one IP address, while registered to the person who receives notice of an infringement, is available for use of a number of individuals at any given time. Even in such instances, however, accuracy is crucial. Where, for example, a parent or employer receives notice, he or she may know or be able to determine who was using the IP address at the time of the alleged infringement and could take steps to discourage or halt continued copyright infringement. Similarly, while institutions or businesses offering internet access to the public may not know precisely who used their IP address to illegally share copyrighted works online, they may be able, upon receiving notice, to take steps to secure its internet account with its ISP against online copyright infringement in the future. 36. What then does an ISP's implicit obligations to accurately determine who must receive notice under paragraph 41.26.1a specifically entail? Before this court, Voltage submitted that an ISP must identify the name and physical address of the person to whom notice is forwarded in order to satisfy its obligations under paragraph 41.26.1a. This, it reasoned, is because the notice and notice regime was intended to operate alongside the Norwich order process. And given that a Norwich order, if obtained, will require an ISP to disclose the name and physical address of the person who was sent the notice under the regime, Voltage says that it only makes sense if these details first be identified at the time that notice is forwarded. 37. Respectfully, I cannot agree. Section 41.26 sub 1 sub a requires an ISP to determine to whom the IP address belonged only in order to, quote, forward the notice electronically, end quote, to them. The requirement of electronic as opposed to personal delivery can be discharged in various ways that do not require an ISP to know the relevant person's name and physical address. In this case, for example, Roger says that it forwards notice electronically via email. What paragraph 41.26.1a requires of an ISP, therefore, is 1. Determining who was assigned the IP address specifically in the notice, so as to allow the notice to be forwarded electronically to that person, and 2. Verifying the accuracy of that determination, so as to ensure that the person who received notice is in fact the person to whom the IP address specified in the notice belongs. Again, to be clear, paragraph 41.26.1a does not simply require an ISP to identify that person by name or physical address, but merely to determine that person as the person to whom the impugned IP address belonged. 38. I note that the steps which an ISP must take to verify, that is, to verify that it has forwarded the notice to the correct person, may depend upon the method by which the ISP forwards notice electronically under paragraph 41.26.1a. In this case, for example, Rogers says that one of the systems it uses to forward notice via email is automated to correlate with the impugned IP address contained in a copyright owner's notice to the email address belonging to the person who was assigned that IP address at the time of the alleged infringement. This system then forwards the copyright owner's notice to that person via email and confirms to the copyright owner that it has done so. Rogers says that there is no indication that its automated system is inaccurate. Rogers' automated system is not, however, used in all circumstances. In some cases, including, it appears, in the case before us, a Rogers employee must, upon receiving a copyright owner's notice, manually look up the email address belonging to the person who was assigned the impugned IP address. Given the differences between these two systems, Rogers may be required to undertake different verification steps where it is required to utilize its manual as opposed to automated process. 39. Returning to my finding that an ISP is not required to identify the name and address of a person receiving notice under paragraph 41.26.1a, this view of an ISP's obligation is reinforced by the scheme of the notice and notice regime. Reading paragraphs 41.26.1a together with 41.26.1b, which requires an ISP to, quote, retain records that, quote, will allow the identity of the person to whom the electronic location belongs to be determined, end quote, it will become clear that paragraph 41.26.1a contemplates that an ISP will not have already determined a person's specific identity, e.g. name and physical address. 40. Moreover, to read paragraph 41.26.1a as requiring an ISP to determine the name and physical address of a person to whom it forwards notice would not be consistent with the notice and notice regime's purpose of balancing the interests of all stakeholders. Every month, Rogers receives approximately 200,000 to 300,000 notices of claimed copyright infringement, each of which must be forwarded in accordance with paragraph 41.26.1a. Only a small portion of these notices ultimately result in Norwich orders, requiring Rogers to disclose the name and physical address of a person who has received notice. Recognizing an implicit requirement in paragraph 41.26.1a for Rogers to identify the name and physical address of those hundreds of thousands of persons to whom it forwards notices each month would force Rogers to undertake identification work in all cases, even though the vast majority of notices sent will never culminate in a Norwich order. In my view, this would undermine the balance struck by Parliament within the notice and notice regime between the respective interests of ISPs and of copyright owners. 41. It must be borne in mind that being associated with an IP address that is the subject of a notice under paragraph 41.26.1a is not conclusive of guilt. As I have explained, the person to whom an IP address belonged at the time of an alleged infringement may not be the same person who has shared copyrighted contents online. It is also possible that an error on the part of the copyright owner would result in the incorrect identification of an IP address as having been the source of online copyright infringement. Requiring an ISP to identify by name and physical address the person to whom the pertinent IP address belonged would therefore not only alter the balance which Parliament struck in legislating the notice and notice regime, but do so to the detriment of the privacy interests of persons, including innocent persons, receiving notice. Subheading B. Section 41.26 sub 1 sub B. Paragraph 42. An ISP's third express obligation under the notice and notice regime to retain records that will, quote, allow the identity of the person to whom the electronic location belongs to be determined, end quote, is contained in paragraph 41.26.1b. The Federal Court of Appeal found this express obligation to carry with it an implicit obligation to maintain those records in a manner and form that will allow identity to be determined, quote, by those who will use the records, end quote, being, quote, the copyright owner who needs to know the identity of the suspected infringers so it can determine its options, end quote, and, quote, a court that will need to know the identity of the suspected infringers so that it can determine the issues of copyright infringement and remedy, end quote. To the extent that the records are in a, quote, form usable by the ISP to identify suspected infringers, but are not in a manner and form usable by copyright owners and courts, end quote, the Federal Court of Appeal held that the ISP must convert the records, end quote, must perform that work as part of its paragraph 41.26.1b obligations, end quote. 43. I find myself in respectful disagreement with that conclusion. Section 41.26 sub 1 sub b does not require an ISP to actually disclose the records to which the provision refers. In other words, section 41.26 sub 1 sub b does not contemplate that anyone other than the ISP will have access to or use of its records. At the very least, it does not follow from the statutory text that records, to which copyright owners and courts have no access, must be kept in a readable format that would permit copyright owners and courts to determine a person's identity from them. I acknowledge that it might be argued that paragraph 41.26.1b leaves this question open, since while referring to, quote, records that will allow the identity of the person to whom the electronic location belongs to be determined, end quote, it does not specify by whom. Absent a disclosure mechanism, however, the better interpretation, in my view, is that paragraph 41.26.1b is referring to a, quote, determination, end quote, by the ISP. 44. This view is supported by paragraph 41.26.1b's requirement that an ISP, quote, retain, end quote, records which allow identity to be determined. Quote, retain, end quote, suggests something which already exists, that is, quote, allowing to remain in place of discarding or removing, to preserve, or to hold fixed in some place or position, end quote. The Oxford English Dictionary, 2nd edition. Retaining, therefore, connotes preservation of the records, and not further act of, quote, translating the records into a manner and form that allows them to be used by copyright owners and later the courts, end quote, from the Court of Appeals reasons. While an ISP merely retaining the records without further translation by converting its records into a new format or compiling records into a new kind of record might well make it impossible for copyright owners or the courts to use the records to identify a person's name and physical address, it would not typically prevent the ISP from doing so. 45. The interpretation is also consistent with the overall scheme within which the deterrent purpose of the notice and notice regime is pursued. As I have recounted, when it enacted the notice and notice regime, Parliament knew that the regime was only the first step in deterring online copyright infringement, and that a copyright owner who wished to sue an alleged infringer would still be required to obtain a Norwich order to identify that person. A Norwich order requiring an ISP to identify and disclose the suspected copyright infringer's name and physical address from its records will not be satisfied where an ISP simply discloses records that are in a form which are unusable to the copyright owner or the court. Rather, ISPs subject to a Norwich order must identify and disclose the name and physical address from their records of persons who are alleged to have infringed copyright. See Voltage Pictures LLC and John Doe, 2011 FC 1024, and Voltage Pictures case from 2014. 46. Finally, I stress that paragraph 41.26(1)(b), like paragraph 41.26(1)(a), implicitly requires an ISP to maintain records which allow it to accurately determine the identity of the person to whom the impugned IP address belonged. I agree with the Federal Court of Appeal that the notice and notice regime should be interpreted so as to, quote, allow copyright owners to protect and vindicate their rights as quickly, easily, and efficiently as possible, while ensuring fair treatment of all, end quote. Inaccurate identification by an ISP and the delay that would follow undermines that prompt vindication of their rights. Indeed, given the rapidity with which copyrighted content is shared via simultaneous downloading and uploading on peer-to-peer networks, inaccurate identification might hollow out those rights altogether. The purpose of paragraph 41.26(1)(b) is to allow for identification when an ISP is required to do so by court order. It is therefore of utmost importance that an ISP retain its records in an accurate manner and form in order to ensure prompt identification. Subheading C, conclusion on section 41.26 sub 1. Paragraph 47. In brief, the three express obligations contained in paragraphs 41.26(1)(a) and 41.26(1)(b) carry with them several implicit obligations that an ISP must satisfy under the notice and notice regime. Specifically, paragraph 41.26(1)(a) requires an ISP to determine, for the purposes of forwarding notice electronically, the person to whom an IP address belonged. It also requires an ISP to take whatever steps that are necessary to verify that it has done so accurately, lest it risk statutory liability for failing to accurately forward notice to the person. It does not, however, require an ISP to determine the name and physical address of that person. 48. Similarly, the records that an ISP retains under paragraph 41.26(1)(b) must be accurate. Any steps which are necessary to verify the accuracy of those records therefore form part of an ISP's paragraph 41.26(1)(b) obligations. That said, while those records must be kept in a form and manner that allow an ISP to identify the name and address of the person to whom notice is forwarded under section 41.26 sub 1 sub a, section 41.26 sub 1 sub b does not require that they are kept in a form and manner that would permit a copyright owner or a court to do so. The copyright owner would, however, be entitled to receive the information from an ISP under the terms of a Norwich order, which process, as I have already said, falls outside the ISP's obligations under the notice and notice regime. Subheading D, section 41.26 sub 2, paragraph 49. As I have explained, in view of the minister not having set a maximum fee by regulation, subsection 41.26(2) precludes an ISP from charging any fee for satisfying its express statutory notice and notice obligations. What, however, of the ISP's implicit identification and verification obligations under the notice and notice regime? May an ISP recover its costs of compliance with the Norwich order the steps which it says it must take to comply with the order overlap with, for example, the implicit obligations under section 41.26 to verify the accuracy of its records? 50. Voltage argues that where such implicit statutory limitations overlap with the steps that an ISP says it would have to take in order to comply with a Norwich order, an ISP is not entitled to recover the costs of such steps. Rogers points out, however, that copyright owners have always been required at common law to compensate an ISP for its, quote, reasonable costs of compliance, end quote, with a Norwich order. See Voltage Pictures, 2014. For Parliament to be taken as having intended to oust that common law rule, Rogers argues, it must have done so expressly and with irresistible clearness. See Parry Sound District Social Services Administration Board and OPSU Local 324, 2003, SEC 42, voting Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company of Canada and T. Eaton Company, 1956, Supreme Court of Canada.
See also Canada Attorney General and Thuin,
2017, SCC 46. 51. In my view, Voltage's argument should prevail on this point. Absent a regulation fixing a maximum fee, subsection 41.26(2) prohibits an ISP from charging a fee for performing any of its obligations arising under the notice and notice regime. I have found that these obligations implicitly include 1. Determining for the purposes of forwarding notice electronically who was assigned to the impugned IP address at the time of the alleged infringement. 2. Taking all steps necessary to verify that the ISP has done so accurately. And 3. Taking all steps necessary to verify the accuracy of records which would permit the ISP to identify the name and physical address of the person to whom notice was forwarded. Those obligations will have first arisen under subsection 41.26(1). That is, prior to the ISP's obligations arising under a Norwich order. It follows that an ISP should not be permitted to recover the costs of carrying out any of the obligations, express or implicit, that will already have arisen under subsection 41.26(1), when it takes them only after having been served with a Norwich order. To accept Rogers' argument to the contrary would undermine the distribution of financial burden, which Parliament decided upon by imposing upon copyright owners an obligation which was specifically allocated by joint operation of subsections 41.26(1) and 41.26(2) to ISPs. 52. To be clear, there is a distinction between an ISP's obligation under the notice and notice regime to ensure accuracy of its records that allow the identity of the person to whom an ISP address belonged to be determined, and an ISP's obligation under a Norwich order to actually identify a person from its records. While the costs of the latter are recoverable, the costs of the former are not. Where, however, the steps that an ISP says it must take to verify the identity of a person in response to a Norwich order involve, in effect, verifying the accuracy of the very records which it was required by subsection 41.26(1) to retain, the ISP cannot recover the resulting costs. 53. Finally, it bears mentioning that an ISP is not entitled to be compensated for every cost that it incurs in complying with the Norwich order. Voltage Pictures, 2015. Recoverable costs must 1. Be reasonable, and 2. Arise from compliance with the Norwich order. Where costs should have been borne by an ISP in performing its statutory obligations under subsection 41.26(1), these costs cannot be characterized as either reasonable or as arising from compliance with the Norwich order. Subheading C, Application. Paragraph 54. I turn now to the motion judge's order that Rogers be entitled to its reasonable costs of $100 per hour plus HST, and the Federal Court of Appeals decision to set it aside. The motion judge properly found that the notice and notice regime requires ISPs to bear the costs of satisfying their statutory obligations. He also found, however, that the regime, quote, only obligated an ISP to do 2 things, end quote. 1. Forward notice under paragraph 41.26(1A), and 2. Retain records under paragraph 41.26(1B). He continued to find that Rogers' proposed fee of $100 per hour plus HST for steps taken to comply with the Norwich order, quote, is what it is, end quote, and that Voltage would have to reimburse Rogers at that rate if it wished to obtain John Doe's identity. At no point in his reasons did the motions judge examine the steps which Rogers said were required to comply with the Norwich order. Specifically, the motion judge did not consider whether any of those steps should already have been undertaken by Rogers to comply with its obligations under the notice and notice regime. 55. Given the statutory prohibition on the recovery of costs arising from the notice-to-notice regime, motion judges should carefully review an ISP's evidence to determine whether an ISP's proposed fee is reasonable in light of its obligations under the notice-to-notice regime. The evidence here, for example, is that Rogers undertakes an 8-step manual process when it is ordered by the court to disclose the identity of one of its subscribers. These 8 steps, as described by a Rogers employee, are 1. The request is logged by a security analyst. The analyst enters the date, time, information requested, affected services, due date, and information about the requester into a database. 2. In the case of an IP address lookup, when the log entry enters the work queue to be processed, the IP is checked against an internet resource by a second security analyst to verify that it is indeed a Rogers cable IP address. 3. The security analyst assigned to process the request searches the IP address against a dedicated Rogers database that records all the users of any given IP address within the past 12 months, approximately. The query is narrowed to specific date and time parameters in order to identify a specific modem. 4. The modem identification information is queried against a duplicate modem list to determine whether the modem has been cloned. 5. The modem is searched in the Rogers customer database. 3 separate verifications are then performed to ensure that the correct customer has been identified. 6. Screenshots are made of the information generated in steps 2 through 5 and saved to a file as backup documentation. 7. The security analyst creates a document with the requested results and logs the completion date. 8. An investigator in the lawful access response group then reviews the screenshots and results document. If the investigator is satisfied with the result, it will be forwarded to the requesting parties. Investigators log their participation in the process and then close the file. Paragraph 56. In my respectful view, the motion judge erred in law by failing to interpret the full scope of an ISP's obligation under subsection 41.26(1), and then by failing to consider whether any of these 8 steps overlap with Rogers' statutory obligations for which it was not entitled to reimbursement. The Federal Court of Appeal therefore correctly set aside the motion judge's order. That said, I find myself in respectful disagreement with the Federal Court of Appeal's decision that the costs for which Rogers may recover in complying with the Norwich Order are limited to those incurred in the act of disclosure, although I do agree that Rogers is entitled to recover those costs. As I have explained, the statutory notice and notice regime, as I read it, does not require an ISP to maintain records in a manner or form that would allow copyright owners or a court to discern the identity and physical address of the person to whom notice was sent. In response to a Norwich order requiring it to furnish such information or other supporting information, an ISP is therefore entitled to the reasonable costs of steps that are necessary to discern a person's identity from the accurate records retained under paragraph 41.26(1)(b). While these costs, even when combined, may well be small, I would not assume that they will always be negligible, as the Federal Court of Appeal anticipates. 57. I do, however, agree with the Federal Court of Appeal that on this record, it is impossible to determine Rogers' reasonable cost of compliance in this case. As indicated above, to the extent the motion judge assessed the fee charged by Rogers, that assessment was not undertaken with reference to section 41.26 properly interpreted. In the circumstances, which include the difficult and novel questions of statutory interpretation presented by this appeal, I would return this matter to the motion judge to allow Rogers to prove its reasonable cost of compliance, and given those same circumstances, Rogers should be entitled to adduce new evidence to prove its reasonable cost of compliance with the Norwich Order. Part 4, Conclusion. Paragraph 58. I would therefore allow Rogers' appeal. Rogers is entitled to its reasonable cost of compliance with the Norwich Order. The quantum of its entitlement is remitted to the motion judge of the federal court to be determined in accordance with this court's interpretation of sections 41.25 and 41.26 of the Act. 59. As to costs, it is now a precondition of a Norwich order that an ISP is entitled to its reasonable legal costs incurred in Norwich order proceedings. See BMG Canada Court of Appeal decision. I would therefore restore the motion judge's order awarding Rogers its legal costs of $500. Given the unusual circumstances of this appeal, which I have already described, however, as well as the divided success throughout the proceedings, I would direct that the parties bear their own costs at this court and the Federal Court of Appeal. See Cartier International AG and British Telecommunications PLC, 2018 UK SC 28. The following are the reasons delivered by Justice Côté. Part 1, Overview. Paragraph 60. I agree that the appeal should be allowed. The Court of Appeal, 2017 FCA 97, erred in imposing a series of implied obligations on Internet Service Providers, ISPs, that cannot and should not be read into the statute, especially in light of the presumption that changes to the common law require a, quote, clear and unequivocal expression of legislative intent, end quote. See Canada Attorney General, 2017 SCC 46. Justice Brown rightly rejects many aspects of that analysis. 61. I would, however, go further than my colleague Justice Brown. In my view, none of the 8 steps that Rogers Communications, Inc. undertakes in response to a Norwich order is supplanted by the statutory notice and notice regime. See Norwich Pharmacal Co. and Customs and Excise Commissioners, House of Lords decision. I also disagree with the proposition that any implied obligations in subsection 41.26(1) of the Copyright Act categorically preclude an ISP from verifying aspects of its records at the time that a Norwich order is received and then seeking compensation for that work. Assuming that Rogers' 8-step process is otherwise reasonable, a determination that does not appear to have been made by the motion judge at first instance, 2016 FC 881, Rogers is entitled to full compensation for the steps it takes to identify an account holder and to disclose that identity to a copyright claimant. Part 2. Analysis. Paragraph 62. In the context of this appeal, the notice and notice regime imposes 2 sets of statutory obligations on ISPs, neither of which is at present subject to compensation. First, under paragraph 41.26(1)(a), an ISP must forward a notice of claimed infringement electronically to the person to whom the electronic location identified by the location data provided by a copyright claimant belongs, and must then inform the claimant whether or not the notice was successfully forwarded. Second, under paragraph 41.26(1)(b), an ISP must, quote, retain records that will allow the identity of that person to be determined, end quote. Taking together, these provisions make clear that an ISP need not actually determine the identity of an alleged infringer. As Justice Brown concludes, there is no obligation to retain these records in any particular manner or form. Thus, any work required to determine an alleged infringer's identity and to disclose that identity pursuant to a Norwich order is not subsumed within the notice and notice regime and can therefore be subject to compensation in accordance with the common law. I agree with the majority to this extent. But how does this interpretation apply to Rogers? 63. Rogers is one of Canada's largest ISPs, receiving upwards of 2 million infringement notice requests per year. That amounts to more than 5,000 per day. Because of this high volume, it processes these requests using an automated platform. A copyright holder submits a request to the platform through an electronic portal, providing IP Internet Protocol address information of the alleged infringer. The platform then automatically sends the infringement notice to the email address of the Rogers account holder associated with the specified IP information. To borrow an example that my colleague Justice Gascon used in the hearing, the platform may automatically send an infringement notice to gohabsgo@gmail.com if that is the email address linked to the specified IP information according to Rogers' electronic system. But at no point does Rogers actually determine the name of the person alleged to have engaged in copyright infringement, the owner of the gohabsgo@gmail.com email account, in response to a notice and notice request, let alone the person's physical address or other identifying information. Rogers submits that this process complies with its statutory obligations under paragraph 41.26(1)(a), and Voltage does not appear to contest this point. 64. In contrast, Rogers receives between 1,500 and 3,000 lookup requests of the type made by Voltage each year. Norwich orders. It responds to these requests manually through a process that involves multiple staff members and lookups across different databases. It does not employ an automated process because the number of requests is comparatively low, and the cost of error improperly disclosing an account holder's personal information to a third party and erroneously subjecting the account holder to service of legal process is comparatively high. Rogers also submits that this process simply cannot be automated. Unlike notice and notice requests, which are typically submitted in identically formatted electronic documents by copyright holders that have registered with Rogers, court orders must be examined manually to ensure that they are legitimate and to determine the specific nature of the information requested. 65. According to Justice Brown, the notice and notice regime imposes an implied obligation on Rogers to accurately determine to whom the automated notice must be forwarded under paragraph 41.26(1)(a). Likewise, he draws a distinction between, quote, ensuring the accuracy of records that allow the identity of the person to whom an IP address belonged to be determined, end quote, for which an ISP cannot be compensated, and, quote, verifying the identity of an individual in response to a Norwich order, end quote, for which an ISP can be compensated, on the basis of another implied obligation. He then instructs the motion judge to reassess Rogers' process in light of this understanding. 66. In my view, the entirety of Rogers' 8-step process falls into the second bucket. Rogers is not, quote, in effect verifying the accuracy of the very records which it was required by subsection 41.26(1) to retain, end quote, from Justice Brown's reasons. It is determining and verifying the identity of a person which it does not already know based on those records. It does so by logging the request, verifying that the account is a Rogers account, querying other databases, such as the duplicate modem list and the customer database, and screenshotting the results for review by another employee. This amounts to a comprehensive and thorough means of accurately identifying the person associated with the IP information provided by the copyright holder. The process assumes that Rogers has accurately sent an automated infringement notice, if such notice was requested, to the email address linked in its system to the IP information provided by the copyright holder. It simply correlates and cross-references various other records to ensure that an account holder is identified correctly. The fact that Rogers may have already determined a person's email address through its automated platform does not render any of the 8 steps duplicative or redundant, especially since a copyright holder is not obliged to proceed through the notice and notice platform before submitting a Norwich request. It remains open to the motion judge to adopt this reading of the statute after Rogers has had the opportunity to adduce new evidence on these points. 67. But in the alternative, even if some steps in Rogers' Norwich process could be characterized as, quote, verifying, end quote, pre-existing information or records, I respectfully reject Justice Brown's conclusion that Rogers should be precluded from seeking compensation on the basis of any purported implied obligation in subsection 41.26(1). 68. For one thing, customer information, including physical addresses, email addresses, and phone numbers, can change over time, and a Norwich order may be received well after an automated notice of infringement is sent to the account holder. The accuracy of that information must still be verified at the time the account holder's identity is being requested by the copyright holder. After all, it is the account holder's current identifying information that a claimant must obtain in order to initiate a legal proceeding for copyright infringement, not the identifying information as it may have existed when the automated infringement notice was sent. Or, put more accurately, if and when an automated notice was sent. Indeed, this is precisely the information that Voltage requested in its motion. 69. But more importantly, it is of course possible that not all of the millions of infringement notices generated by Roger's automated platform are sent to the correct account holder in accordance with paragraph 41.26(1)(a). In some cases, it may be entirely outside of Roger's control. For example, where an account holder improperly enters an email address into his or her account profile, causing Rogers to send the notice to someone else. In other cases, there may be complicating factors that are identified only through Rogers' manual process and not through the automated platform. 70. For Justice Brown, the answer to this problem is that Rogers cannot seek compensation for verifying anything it has done through its automated platform. In effect, it must assume that the automated platform makes its way to the correct person each and every time, for every one of the millions of notice requests it receives. But if we accept the reality that the automated platform may sometimes result in errors, Rogers is left with only two options. According to Justice Brown, either it must redesign its automated system around the identification needs that affect only a minuscule subset of those cases, or it must undertake manual verifications in response to a Norwich order for free. 71. With respect, I see things differently. A party responding to a Norwich order is entitled to reimbursement for reasonable costs of compliance. See Glaxo Wellcome PLC and MNR. Federal Court of Appeal, 1998. So what is reasonable in this context? Given that Rogers receives more than 2 million notice and notice requests each year, the fraction of cases in which a notice is not sent to the correct account holder by the automated platform may not justify adopting the degree of manual verifications that Rogers employs in response to Norwich orders. But in the Norwich context, where there are substantially fewer requests and a higher cost if an error is made, there may be good justifications for conducting more rigorous verifications. It is therefore reasonable for Rogers to undertake such verifications, recognizing that the sheer number of notice and notice requests it receives may make perfect compliance an illusory goal in that context. There is no, quote, irresistible clearness, end quote, in the statute to justify displacing this otherwise sensible approach on the basis of a purported implied obligation. See Parry Sound District Social Services Administration Board and OPSU Local 324, 2003 SCC 42. 72. Of course, Rogers does not have free rein to conduct whatever verifications it chooses and to saddle copyright holders with the associated costs. The common law Norwich regime permits an ISP to be compensated only for, quote, reasonable, end quote, steps to comply with an order. Thus, to the extent that an ISP performs unnecessarily extensive or duplicative verifications, judges are empowered to deny the costs of those verifications. But that authority comes from the common law, not from an interpretation of this statute. If, for example, an ISP engaged in a manual lookup of an account holder's name, but redundantly assigned that task to 10 different staff members, each performing an identical and superfluous function, a judge could undoubtedly deny compensation on the basis that such steps were not reasonable. 73. The problem here is that the motion judge does not appear to have made an independent finding as to the reasonableness of Rogers' 8-step process. He did conclude that Rogers' fee of $100 per hour was reasonable, a finding that counsel for Voltage conceded was, quote, thoroughly canvassed, end quote, in the underlying decision, and therefore need not be addressed again. but whether Rogers may charge $100 per hour does not answer the question of what Rogers may charge $100 per hour to do. 74. On my interpretation of the statute, of course, Rogers' eight-step process is not subsumed within the notice and notice regime. And as I have mentioned, it remains open to the motion judge, under Justice Brown's reasons, to adopt this interpretation and to conclude that Rogers' process is otherwise reasonable. But even on my reading of the statute, I would still remit the matter for determination of whether the time that Rogers spends completing its eight-step process is reasonable. The motion judge should make a finding on this point in the first instance, separate and apart from his finding on the reasonableness of the hourly rate. Part 3, Conclusion. Paragraph 75. For the reasons described above, I concur with Justice Brown that the appeal should be allowed and the matter remitted to the motion judge for further proceedings. Appeal allowed.